For the Life of the World is a production of the Yale Center for Faith and Culture. For more information, visit faith.yale.edu. Before we jump into this episode, just a quick announcement that next week, Friday, October 30th at 1 p.m. Eastern, Miroslav Volf will be hosting novelist and essayist Marilyn Robinson for a special conversation about living faithfully in this political moment. Robinson is perhaps most well known for her Gilead series, the most recent installment of which just came out, Jack. And we're taking questions. So if you'd like to submit a question for consideration in the conversation, please email us at faith@yale.edu. We're going to be premiering the video of that conversation on our YouTube page and offering more information in the coming week. Hope you'll join us for this special online event. This is For the Life of the World, a podcast about seeking and living a life worthy of our humanity. I'm Evan Rosa with the Yale Center for Faith and Culture. The United States is around 13% African American. In the House, 51 out of 435 are Black representatives, 8.5%. In the Senate, 3 out of 100 are Black. In fact, there are only 10 in U.S. history. Only 2 Black governors have ever been elected. So the proportional representation of Black Americans in government is very far off. But this year, as we get closer and closer to the election, apart from the circus that is the presidential race, down the ballot, seats in Congress and other state and local offices are up for grabs, and more Black candidates are emerging. 130 Black women are running for office across the country. And the way these go will contribute to a significant impact on the future of our country as we struggle to emerge from 2020. So much at stake, adding in the factors of partisan sorting along ideological lines and the movement of party politics to extremes. The very concept of truth-seeking, justice-seeking debate. It's important to understand the moment that we're in. For equal racial representation in government, for the goods of diversity that resist factionalism and zero-sum power games, and ultimately, for flourishing in a union that is fledgling toward the more perfect. So today on the podcast, Ryan McAnally-Lins interviews Emory University political scientist Andra Gillespie. Dr. Gillespie is associate professor of political science and director of the James Weldon Johnson Institute for the Study of Race and Difference at Emory University. She earned a bachelor's degree from the University of Virginia and her PhD in political science from Yale University. Gillespie teaches courses on American politics, race and politics, and qualitative methodology. Her 3 books are Who's Black Politics? Cases in Post-Racial Black Leadership, The New Black Politician, Cory Booker, Newark, and Post-Racial America, and Race and the Obama Administration, Symbols, Substance, and Hope. She and Ryan discuss the significance of Black politics in 2020, including the need to fix disproportional representation, the experience and salience of racial identity as a grounding factor for Black political engagement, pursuing justice through the political process, voting rights, and bringing political science to bear on lives of faith. Thanks for listening.
Dr. Gillespie, thank you so much for taking some time to join us and talk. This must be a pretty busy time for somebody in your line of work with the election just around the corner. A lot of your research focuses on African-American political campaigns and especially how they operate when seeking statewide office. And this year we have a number of those candidates and a couple of candidates who were or are seeking nationwide office. You've got Cory Booker and Kamala Harris as candidates in the Democratic primary. Harris is on the ticket with Biden now. And you have 2 Senate candidates in the South, and Jamie Harrison in South Carolina and Raphael Warnock in your home state of Georgia. What strikes you as most significant about these campaigns, and where do they stand kind of in the history of African-American political participation in the states?
Well, first, thank you for having me. This year is interesting for a number of reasons, not just, you know, what we expect in terms of record-breaking turnout in the election and just the urgency of the issues that are at stake, but also looking at how African-American candidates and other candidates of color are responding to the moment and putting their hat in the race to run for office. And so you've mentioned Jamie Harrison and Raphael Warnock. They probably have 2 of the biggest profiles in terms of running for office, but throughout the South and actually even in other parts of the country, we see candidates of color running for the U.S. Senate. So whether we're talking about Republican John James in Michigan or Mike Espy in Mississippi, or Adrian Perkins in Louisiana, or Marquita Bradshaw in Tennessee, there actually are a number of African-American candidates running for the U.S. Senate. What is interesting about this year is that, of course, you know, if any of these candidates win, they won't be the first Blacks to be elected to the U.S. Senate. But any increase in the number of senators creates this massive increase. You know, we only have three Black U.S. senators. And if Joe Biden wins the presidency, then Kamala Harris becomes vice president. And so that number goes down to two with just Cory Booker and Tim Scott. So if Jamie Harrison and Raphael Warnock in particular are successful in their Senate bids, because they're the ones that are doing the best in the polls right now, so this is why we're going to focus on them. You know, we would see the number of African-American senators increase to four. And I think it's important to point that out, that that would be the largest number of Blacks to be in the Senate at any one time. And the fact that it's four suggests that we still have a really long way to go. I mean, we're almost at proportional representation in the House of Representatives, but we're nowhere near proportional representation in the U.S. Senate, right? And we still have many more seats to go before we hit that, you know, 12 to 13 senators that would make us proportional.
Can you explain a little bit about why that gap between the House and the Senate? What's different between the two bodies that would make that the case?
You know, it has to do with just sort of the geographic dispersion of African Americans and racial polarization in voting. So at the congressional level, where members of Congress are representing districts of, you know, about between 700 and 750,000 people, district lines could be drawn in ways that could make it relatively easy for African Americans to get elected. So now, I should be very clear, for the last 25 years, the Supreme Court has outlawed drawing district lines on the basis of race. But before that, they did allow it, and particularly after the 1990 census and the 91 reapportionment, we saw a significant increase in the number of Black and Hispanic members of Congress, because states were drawing districts with large numbers of Black and brown constituents, with the goal of actually increasing the representation of racial minorities in the House. So you can't do that anymore. But because of the ways that partisanship and race correlate with each other, when districts are being drawn for partisan reasons, even if you're not, you know, making the districts 80% minority, they still tend to have large enough minority populations that in the districts where it's possible, people of color are the ones who are choosing candidates. And oftentimes their choices are candidates of color, because those are the people who live in the district and they're putting their hat in the race to run for office. And so, you know, we, you know, have seen growing numbers of people of color winning races, because America is changing demographically. And so these folks are running because it's their right to run, and they want to be fully involved and invested in the process. You know, so in the 90s, it was aided, you know, by racial gerrymandering, in the early 90s, at least. And so today we are still seeing continued growth in the number of Black, Latinx, and Asian American members of Congress, because people are actually, like, you know, running for office, and people are stepping up and putting themselves into position. So in some instances, it's just that if you can't win if you don't run. And so we are seeing more people run, and, you know, we expect them to be successful, and they're winning office in majority minority districts. And they're also winning in districts where minorities are where there is no clear majority. So, you know, it could be overall majority minority, or it could be plurality white. Or in some instances, it still is, majority white, and folks are figuring out how to craft a message that's actually going to reach the voters that are in their district. That's different at the statewide level. And at the statewide level, there are very few states that are majority minority. We are seeing more states that have become majority minority recently, or are on the track to become majority minority. So Georgia is definitely one of those that will be majority minority by about the middle of this century. But historically, especially in the South, if the majority of residents in the state are white, and we see a racial polarization in terms of party identification and voting, And you have a large white population that votes majority Republican because of shifts in partisan identification that happened amongst Southern whites in the latter half of the 20th century. And then you have a majority of people of color who are not as numerically numerous coming in and voting, you know, overwhelmingly Democratic, right? There's still just this numbers imbalance that there are more white Republicans than there are Democrats of color and even white Democrats. And so there's just been this balance, which has made it really hard for candidates of color to win statewide. That's, you know, it's not uniformly true. You know, we could look at the electoral successes of people like Robert Menendez and Cory Booker, who are aided in New Jersey just by the fact that they're, you know, that most people in the state are Democrats, regardless of their race. And we've seen the success of minority Republicans in southern states like Florida and South Carolina and Texas, who are able to sort of lean into the partisan sort of culture of the state and manage to win statewide office. But it's just been really difficult for Southern Democrats of any race to be able to win statewide office. And, you know, that's been true for African-Americans as well.
So how do you think that that correlation of race and partisanship, what sort of dynamics is it putting at play today? How does it interact with the increasing partisan polarization of the country as a whole and the kind of ideological sorting that happens where you used to have parties where there were plenty of people who thought of themselves as conservative and were Democrats or thought of themselves as liberal Republicans. And that's really no longer the case.
Yeah. I mean, first I want to compliment you on your definition of ideological sorting and getting that in there. You know, it plays itself out in different types of dynamics. So one of the ways that it may play itself out is in terms of how of candidates, particularly candidates of color, self-presentation. And so while ideological sorting is real, it's also important to point out that it is not as prevalent in communities of color as it is amongst whites. So because of the racial dynamics that, you know, pushed white Southern Democrats towards the Republican Party starting in the 60s and 70s and, you know, came to full fruition in the late aughts and early teens of this decade, we have seen a reluctance amongst African-American and Hispanic Democrats who are conservative to align themselves with the Republican Party because of issues related to race, civil rights, immigration. And so Democrats have a perceptual advantage on racial issues, and that explains the differences in partisanship between whites and non-whites. It varies. And so it looks different if we're looking across different racial and ethnic groups. So how that manifests itself in African-American communities is different than it's going to be how it'll manifest itself in Asian American and Latinx communities. It's there. And so what that means is that amongst communities of color, you actually do have more people who are going to identify as being moderate or even conservative, but they just won't align with the Republican Party because there's this impasse on race and civil rights and related issues. And so what that also means is that when candidates are running, they do need to be mindful of the political culture and the area in which they run. And so sometimes what we have seen is candidates figure out ways to build bridges between the sort of moderate and the progressive camps and figuring out how to sort of like walk that line between those two communities. And it's a process, one that I am studying and, you know, don't have sort of full answers on, but you also watch the candidates themselves try to needle that thread as well. And so there's some people, you know, who looked at 2018 and they looked at Stacey Abrams and Andrew Gillum's run, and they labeled them as, you know, progressives. And, you know, Stacey Abrams certainly is progressive, but Stacey Abrams also developed and cultivated a reputation as a state legislator of being able to work with Republicans. She had to as minority leader and was actually in her primary not considered, didn't get the endorsement actually of leading progressives in the state of Georgia. I mean, and that was fine. I mean, she, you know, won a resounding victory in her primary, but she was able to kind of, you know, straddle the fence between taking some pragmatic stances that could be viewed as moderate and then also embracing some elements of progressivism. And so just the very idea of a Black woman running To be governor of a deep Southern state in and of itself is a radical progressive idea. But that doesn't mean that she was necessarily embracing sort of, you know, every campaign bullet point and agenda of the Democratic Socialists of America. And I think it's really important for us to make those kinds of distinctions. And so depending on the type of office that people are running for, you may see people take what appear to be more moderate stances. And it's in part because of the political culture. And then it also is for the type of office in which they're running. You might actually be able to be more radical if you are, you know, running in a congressional district of, again, about 700, 750,000 people in a really liberal state. But if you have to run for statewide office, then I think the question is whether or not those viewpoints and those positions actually would resonate with a large state where there's going to be more ideological heterogeneity, even, you know, within a partisan coalition like the Democratic coalition, which has, you know, moved left on some issues, but hasn't moved completely left on all issues. And so we're still going to see those ideological fights, you know, how much do we embrace social welfare, for instance, if Democrats were having this debate versus how, you know, much did we retain some neoliberal sort of policy positions and identities, right? That fight is still going to happen. And you're going to see African-American politicians sort out differently based on their values. And then also in some instances, based on their aspirations. And I would still argue that the candidates who are probably best positioned to run statewide are going to be the ones who look a little bit more moderate. They may not look as moderate as they did in 2005 or, you know, in 2001 when I first met Cory Booker at Yale and got that bright idea to start doing this research. I didn't realize what I was doing then, but what became the bright idea to start doing research in this area. But they're still going to look more moderate relative to some other people, prominent players within the party.
Could we focus in on Warnock for a few minutes here? He's the senior pastor at Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta, which is most well known for being Dr. King's church. It strikes me as an interesting question, kind of how his status as pastor has played into the campaign. He's running in the special election in Georgia against not only two Republicans at the moment, but some Democrats as well. So how has his status as a pastor played into the campaign? And then how do you see that in relation to previous political campaigns by Black church leaders, whether that be like Jesse Jackson, Al Sharpton, or those sort of folks?
So, you know, it's really interesting. And actually that race has, I think, 21 people in it. There's so many people, many other Republicans, the other Democrats that you've mentioned, people representing third parties. Reverend Warnock's prominence as a pastor of Ebenezer, I think, gave him a certain foundation on which to build a campaign. And he had to build it. So he didn't immediately come in as the Democratic front runner. It took time for him to be able to consolidate the lead. So kind of, you know, interesting to some of your listeners who you might have connections to Connecticut, one of the other Democrats who is running for this seat happens to be Joe Lieberman's son. And so, you know, early polls suggested that there wasn't a breakout Democratic star, and Warnock was able to succeed because he put a coalition together and got some key endorsements. So he long had the support of Stacey Abrams, and then he picked up endorsements from President Obama, from President Carter, was able to raise money to start a statewide ad campaign to increase and improve his name identification. And so it was with that increase in name identification and I think the endorsements that convinced African-American voters that they could take a chance on and consolidate around Warnock as the candidate of choice. And where we start to see Warnock taking the lead in polls was when African-Americans made a definitive choice for Warnock as their preferred Democratic candidate. But having the platform of having been pastor of Ebenezer gives Warnock lots of advantages, because even if you don't know Warnock, you probably know what Ebenezer Baptist Church is and its significance in history. And you know the connection to Martin Luther King. You know, it also gave him a platform to demonstrate his commitment to social justice. So, you know, Ebenezer builds itself. If you ever go to church at Ebenezer on a Sunday morning, the welcome says, "Welcome to America's Freedom Church." And so they are always very cognizant of their role in Black liberation from a theological perspective, and then also its connection to social justice. And he's been very, very vocal about that, whether or not people were paying attention to the times, you know, where he would, you know, get arrested doing civil disobedience and other kinds of things. It certainly gave him a platform. I think the sort of position as a pastor, and he's kind of hinted at this in some of his ads, gives him a platform to sort of claim a moral authority that could stand in contrast to the decay and perceived corruption that many Democrats feel about the Trump administration and about the Republican Party at this particular juncture in time. But it also serves as a bridge because Ebenezer is held in such high esteem in African-American communities, regardless of conservative African-Americans' theological commitments or perspectives, that he can use that as a way to get his foot in the door to start a conversation with folks. And I think that that's worked to his advantage.
Does he speak in his campaign in recognizably theological and or scriptural language on a regular basis? Or is that connection more subtext?
So I haven't heard a campaign event where I could actually speak to that part of it. I mean, if we look at his campaign advertising, you know, this is somebody who I've heard speak plenty of times before. And so the person who I see in the ads is the same person who I've heard, you know, giving speeches or giving sermonettes before. So I don't see it as different. And so, I mean, yes, there's a certain cadence and rhetorical style of a Black preacher that Warnock certainly personalized that I see evidence in his self-presentation. And I think one of the other things is that while he, you know, has now started to do comparison ads, which technically could be classified as negative ads, he has, you know, tried to run a mostly positive campaign where he talks about what he stands for, as opposed to attacking his opponents. Now, he's aided right now in the contest by the fact that the two leading Republican candidates, the incumbent Senator Kelly Loeffler and Congressman Doug Collins, are more than happy to go at each other. You know, if this goes to a runoff, Warnock will undoubtedly be in it, and either, you know, Loeffler or Collins is likely going to be the second place finisher. You know, I suspect that the gloves will come off a little bit more, and he's going to actually have to really, you know, sort of, you know, in his advertising, at least attack, you know, whoever sort of makes it to the runoff with him. But I, you know, I see the restraint in his ads in particular as a, you know, just as a nod to sort of, you know, his background as a pastor. And I think probably natural inclination to try to be more positive than to be negative.
Does that put him in your estimation, continuity with a kind of tradition of Black church leaders seeking public office? Or is that different from the past in any sort of way?
Well, in an earlier question, and I realized I didn't get to it, so I'm happy to get to it now. You sort of asked me to compare Reverend Warnock to Jesse Jackson or to Al Sharpton. And, you know, I'm not sure that I would make that comparison per se. I might even try to go back a little bit more to Adam Clayton Powell, who's a congressman from Harlem, New York in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, who was the pastor of Abyssinian Baptist Church. And so there are going to be some similarities and differences. I mean, the difference in time, I think, is important to understand what was going on there. So, you know, these are both pastors of very prominent African-American churches, right? So, I mean, if you were talking to historians of the African-American experience and of the African-American church, and you wanted to name some of like the big Black churches, you know, Ebenezer and Abyssinian would be in the top five, I think, probably on everybody's list. But so, you know, using sort of the church as a platform for a political office, I think certainly falls into that tradition. The reason why I hesitate to compare Warnock to Jackson and to Sharpton was that the two of them were attempting to run leverage candidacies. So they were aware of the likelihood that they weren't going to win office. And so especially for Jackson in 1988, his goal was to do as best as he could to demonstrate the strength of Black voting power and then use that, even though he might end up being unsuccessful in his bid for the presidency, to demand changes and greater recognition for African-Americans within the party, both in terms of substantive policy issues, but also in terms of behind the scenes leadership positions. And in this particular case, Warnock is actually running to win the seat. And Warnock looks, you know, looks like an extremely competitive candidate who would be, might be able to win the seat. So if Democrats have an overwhelming night on election night, and so what I'm talking about is Joe Biden winning by tidal wave proportions, that would likely include Georgia, which would be unusual because Georgia hasn't voted for a Democratic presidential candidate since Bill Clinton. But it would also suggest that down ballot Democrats would probably be in a really strong position to do better than would be expected. And that might actually, if we see a lot of straight ticket voting amongst Democrats, could actually propel Warnock into office without having to go to a runoff if he could get a clear majority of the vote on November 3rd. And so, you know, if that's the case, he's not running to get leverage within the party or to show that we need to, that African-Americans need to be taken seriously. In fact, I think Stacey Abrams actually did a lot of that hard work and might even try to benefit from that herself when, as I suspect she will, run for governor of Georgia again in 2022. So, you know, what Abrams did was prove that Black Democrats are no more disadvantaged in running for statewide office in Georgia than white Democrats are. And so there's often been this reluctance or fear of putting forward a Black Democratic candidate in the Deep South for fear that they can't get white votes. And, you know, Abrams was able to disprove that. And she was also able to prove just the wisdom of a plan of welcoming all whites who want to vote for Democratic candidates, but making sure that you put in a really concerted effort to reach out to and to mobilize voters of color to turn out and vote. And so I think by one, coming as close as she did to winning the governorship, and also just in terms of absolute votes, doing better than the white Democrats who had recently run for those seats, right? She helped to dispel this myth that Black Democrats just are not competitive in the Deep South. Like, even if they don't win, if they do as well or better than the whites who would otherwise be nominated for those seats, it shows that Blacks deserve to be given opportunities to run for office and shouldn't be held back by the party or for outdated sort of notions of conventional wisdom about how Blacks are disadvantaged. Blacks do face other challenges, right? When they run for office, it doesn't necessarily disadvantage them any more than it would disadvantage their white counterparts, right? The bigger problem sometimes is, you know, having the D behind your name in a state that has more Republicans than Democrats.
So you talked a little bit about how there tends to be more ideological diversity among African-Americans, people of color in their, within a political party than among white voters, that the ideological sorting hasn't really happened as much or as strongly. I'm curious if that, I mean, does faith have anything to do with that? or would that be trying to kind of like shoehorn together two things that are maybe stereotypically thought about when relatively uninformed people are thinking about African-American political participation, right? Democrats and religion, that must somehow go together.
Or Republicanism and religion, right? Well, it's more that the idea of ideological sorting, to the extent that faith correlates with that, has largely been formulated looking at whites. And so we know that the Republican Party made a concerted effort to reach out to white evangelical voters. They court them, they give them stuff. You know, the vice president is evangelical today in an attempt to make sure that they stayed within the Republican camp. We could talk about the ways that the Republican Party used issues related to race, and gender and nationalism and sort of like Christian nationalism to reach out and pursue white voters. So Angie Maxwell and Todd Shield wrote a great book about this. And so we know these things, you know, have happened in white communities. And there was some working assumption that because of the religious conservatism of many African Americans, that it was only a matter of time before Republicans were again competitive in Black communities. And we know that Republicans haven't seriously competed for Black votes since the mid 1960s when Barry Goldwater came out flatly against the Civil Rights Act. And we saw the Republican Party cut its vote share amongst African Americans by about 2/3. And so that's where we get to sort of our standard convention that only about 10% of African Americans are going to vote Republican in presidential elections, right? And the reason why African Americans, you know, are so Democratic, regardless of their ideological positioning, has to do with race. It has to do with the fact that race is the more salient identity, that the lived experiences of African Americans makes that sort of the more salient identity. So they don't prioritize other sorts of positions, and they will figure out a way sort of if they're in conflict to reconcile themselves. So yes, there are pro-life African Americans that is for the most part isn't going to predict their voting behavior, right? Because racism is a more salient issue for them than abortion, even if they, you know, are personally opposed to it, even if they would advise people against it, right? They're not going to set sort of their policy or their voting preferences based on that particular identity if the Republican Party still has this huge blind spot about race, and more importantly, refuses to acknowledge sort of the importance of group identity to minority communities and why that's salient.
You've mentioned Abrams a couple of times. And so she had two opportunities to run for the Senate this year because there are two campaigns going on in Georgia, and she passed on both. And she's focusing instead, at least until 2022, as you mentioned, on expanding voting rights, ensuring a fair count in the 2020 census, and process related issues, that don't seem to be the sort of things that, that light a fire under most voters, right? They're not the headline issues that people say they care about. And I'm wondering if you might speak a little normatively, if you have thoughts on this. You know, why should Christians in particular care about process issues, such as restricting on voting rights, restrictions on voting rights, gerrymandering, the confirmation of Supreme Court nominees in an election year, things like that, that seem maybe a little arcane and removed from life. What's the point of investing concern there?
Well, there are a number of reasons to care about this, you know, from a faith standpoint, and then also for Stacey Abrams, just from a practical standpoint. So the reason why Abrams didn't run for the Senate was because she didn't want to. She had her eyes on an executive seat, and so she didn't want to be distracted by taking a legislative seat. And that would have made it harder for her, especially if she'd won a Senate race, to then quit in 2 years to go run for governor. That's a lot of energy, and I think there would be people who would be really disappointed, and there could be some brand damage to making somebody look too ambitious. And that would be a problem for a male or a female candidate. So I'm not making a gendered comment there. You know, in terms of Abrams, you know, choosing to embrace voting rights, this is one of those places where, you know, I think she and other candidates like her, and so I would put Cory Booker and Jamie Harrison kind of in this category. This is a place where they can credibly talk about race in the Trump era, where you have to talk about race in ways that Barack Obama could have lied in 2008. But you can do so in a consensus kind of non-controversial way, right? We all agree about voting rights. Like, it was one of those, you know, key things that everybody could agree on in the civil rights movement, was that Black people should have the right to vote. You know, you start to have other differences when the issues are more cross-cutting and affect different groups differently within the African-American community, depending on their relative privilege. voting is non-controversial. This is something where you could, in theory, get some bipartisan support for it. We know sort of in reality debates about voting rights, you know, can fall, you know, differently along partisan lines, and you'll have people arguing about things that honestly we shouldn't be arguing about anymore. But, you know, fundamentally, everybody agrees everybody should have the right to vote. So I think it's actually, you know, from a strategic standpoint, it's a way to talk about race when you need to talk about race, but doing so in a way that's actually still not particularly threatening. That being said, voting is fundamental for the functioning of democracy. And having free and fair elections is important. And the reason why it is important to focus on rules, as somebody like Abrams, who, you know, lost by 50,000 votes in an election where people took advantage of rules, perhaps, and we'll never know for sure. But, like, you know, there's always going to be the question of, you know, could a few more people have, you know, were 50,000 people basically discouraged from voting, and would that have made the difference between winning and losing that election? So, I mean, you know, there are some ways that's extremely difficult to measure. And so I think we have to be prepared to never know that answer for sure. But it's rules that are leveraged to disenfranchise people. You know, I think some people still think of sort of like the idea of voter disenfranchisement is, you know, outright intimidation. And, you know, it's the things that we saw sort of depicted in the movie Selma, you know, where people are beaten and shot or, you know, outright prevented from being able to register to vote. We think about the old fashioned literacy tests and poll taxes and grandfather clauses, all of which were very real. And the white primaries in the South and other kinds of things. And, you know, the questions that ask ridiculous things like, you know, how many bubbles are in a bar of soap? You know, those things happened. But those were all done because of rules and how rules were selectively applied or misapplied. And so they matter a whole lot. And so if we see certain rules being either put into place intentionally to try to game it for one side versus the other, or if we see rules being applied selectively, or perhaps not being applied selectively, but still having a disparate impact on some groups over others, that's still voter suppression. And we have to fight it and we have to combat it. And it's important for us to point out that even when some people have the best of intentions, if they put policies into place that are putting unnecessary burdens on people that are disproportionately affecting the people who are the most marginalized and have the greatest disadvantage, we have to go back and rethink those rules and ask, you know, is this absolutely necessary? And how can we fix this rule to achieve the legitimate goals that we need to get done and to make this process more fair? So, I mean, it is all rules are what makes the world work. And there are rules in voting that have historically been used to advantage some groups over others. And if we truly care about freedom and equality, we should be concerned about that.
The idea of playing by the rules sounds like an uncontroversial one, right? But it seems to me like there's, with any given set of rules, there's a possibility of not just playing by them, but playing with them, you know, messing around with them, leveraging them, using them for any number of different purposes. And I wonder, you know, from a faith perspective, like what it seems that a lot of contemporary political culture assumes that you should get away with what you can get away with, but that, I mean, that doesn't seem right to me, kind of from my vantage point as somebody who's trying to think normatively about this, what ought one to do? I'm wondering if you have any wisdom or thoughts to share on that sort of dynamic in our political culture today.
Yeah. I mean, you know, when I think about this from a faith standpoint, you think about things like the letter of the law and the spirit of the law, but we're also thinking about sort of, I think about it from an evangelical standpoint where you think about sort of what the outside actions are, but you're thinking about what the heart condition is. And you could outwardly be doing everything correctly, but if your heart condition is wrong, then you're wrong. And God will call you out for being in error. And in particular, while, you know, I can't say that I, you know, haven't loved the loophole before, when you have a culture that seeks out loopholes, right, that actually suggests to me a certain spirit of rebellion, you know, which the Old Testament says is satanic. So if you're always looking to try to game the system for selfish gain, right, selfishness is a sin. So even if you can technically get away with it sort of in the eyes of people, that doesn't mean that God is pleased with what you're doing. So, and it doesn't make it right, right? Because God is judging the heart. So if you know, to quote the King James, if man is looking on the outward appearance, God is looking on the heart, and your heart is corrupt. And that sin that will separate you from God. So I think it's really important to sort of understand that. I think it's also important to understand that, you know, human nature likes to play tricks on itself. We're always looking for reasons to justify and rationalize what we're doing. And at the end of the day, you know, I believe God wants to get to the quick. And I think that that also is true in terms of how we view sort of people playing election rules. So, you know, I don't want to criticize my governor, but, you know, one of the big objections that Abrams had, and I think it was a legitimate objection, was that he was Secretary of State. So technically, he was in charge of his own election. And so it's a question of, what are the optics of that? You know, we're taught in the New Testament to refrain from the appearance of evil. And, you know, most of the time in modern sort of, especially in evangelical America, all we care about, like, is related to sexual propriety before marriage. But like, this is about more than just like, you know, spending the night at your boyfriend's house and, you know, did you sleep in the same bed or not? Right. Like, you know, there should be something optically wrong with overseeing your own election. So do we, you know, just because the rules didn't say you couldn't do it, doesn't make it okay. And so if we're truly serious about answering to a higher authority, then we also have to think not just about what the letter of the laws of our individual states say or what the sort of federal statutes say, but we also have to think about sort of whether or not this actually aligns with what I think are biblical ethics.
I've kind of asked you to speak in multiple roles here, right? You're a political scientist, you're a Christian. I wonder, what do you think that first role, the political scientist, brings that you would really like your fellow Christians to learn and hear as they go about their lives, particularly in this moment?
You know, well, I think it's interesting. I always want to make sure that my allegiance and my loyalty is to Jesus first and foremost. And so, you know, if I had to sort of pick which identity I'm going to put forward, you know, in practice, I recognize what the places where I don't actually do this in my real life, but my intention is to always put that identity first and foremost. But that doesn't check all of my other identities. In fact, I think all the other identities are ones that God gave me too. You know, so, you know, God knew I was going to be born at this time. Where I would, you know, be classified as African American. He assigned me female at birth. And so like there are these different perspectives that I bring to the table. And I truly believe that I was called to be a political scientist. I don't have any question about sort of like the vocational path that God put me on. And so if God was going to call me to be a political scientist, and actually a Yale-trained political scientist in the early 2000s, right, there is a certain sensibility and there's a certain epistemology that goes along with that, that I also don't think I can check at the door. So when I go to church, like the PhD doesn't go out the window. I still think about things in the ways that I was kind of taught to think about them. And so I think that there are tools that I, you know, have learned through my academic training that could be of service to the church. And certainly help me as I think about things. And, you know, one, I would encourage Christians to be involved in all aspects of the marketplace. You know, there are times when you hear, especially when people want to start arguing about the cultural wars, you know, about how they don't feel represented in certain spheres. Well, sometimes people, you know, were discouraged from actually going into places where they might have truly been called or would have, you know, and would have been good at. Right. Because we had misguided kind of conceptions of what went on in those businesses. So, you know, whether it's don't be an English professor, they're all atheists there. And I'm generalizing, I know that that's not true for all English professors. But yeah, if there's a Christian who really, you know, feels called to study literature, go do it, right? You can be salt and light in those particular spaces. And there are things there that you're going to learn that could help you make sense of who you are and where you fit in God's kingdom. And these could be mutually beneficial relationships. So the first thing I would do is encourage people to be everywhere. And then, you know, I think the second place is that there are things that I learned as a result of being a political scientist that could actually be helpful as people make pronouncements. So I'm going to not say where I heard this, but I remember one time being at a church service. I think I was actually physically there. I don't think I was watching the church service, but where they laid hands on a political candidate. And I remember the pastor saying, and I believe this person is going to win. And sort of, you don't want to contradict the pastor. But I knew that the district voted 80% for the other party. And so I was like, you're not going to win. I'm thinking this under my breath in church. I was just, the numbers don't say that. And then you're sitting there going, well, maybe like this is something prophetic. And like, you know, we're going to see sort of this. It didn't happen. You know, I can, you know, we can sit and sort of think about and help to sort of gently challenge things that might not necessarily, you know, sort of might be based on people's own personal predilections and don't actually have the imprimatur of divine inspiration, and just point out what's going on there. You know, I think this is even the same thing for particularly with churches that are resistant to maintaining social distancing and masking measures. If you, you know, are a Christian epidemiologist, right? Like, I think churches need to open spaces to let these people use their expertise in the service of God's kingdom. And so that I don't hear one more story about, you know, a super spreader event happening at a church because people were too busy being stubborn and about not wearing masks, right? Like we can use those things. And I think that my faith helps to inform my scholarship, because to the extent that I, you know, to where in the places where I am writing about religion or thinking about religion, I bring a certain sensibility to the table that's kind of based off of lived experience. And so I don't, empiricism isn't about sort of just sort of centering one's lived experience. And so I want to be very clear that I'm not trying to be essentialist in that way. But I do think that the lived experience does sometimes give people newer insight to ask different types of questions and to also kind of understand a different interpretation. And sometimes that knowledge that has been cultivated over time naturally just through experience can sometimes come into contact with people who do bring a fresh outsider's perspective to things. And you can figure out sort of where the truth is somewhere in between there. You know, I've certainly sat in talks where people are studying faith communities to which they're unfamiliar, and sometimes they do make mistakes that one could be offensive and actually prevent further study in those communities. Sometimes they say things that are accurate and you needed somebody who was from the outside to actually kind of tell you, look, that's what's going on. Do you see that? And it gives you a different perspective. But also there are times when if you don't come from a community, sometimes you don't know what to ask, or you don't always know how to interpret the things that might be just right in front of you. So I'd like to think that, you know, my faith experience does give me different questions and perhaps a different urgency to answer those questions.
That's it for this episode. Thanks for listening, friends. And we look forward to next Friday when you can join us for a conversation with Marilyn Robinson on living faithfully in this political moment. Don't forget to send us your questions or any inquiries at faith@yale.edu. For the Life of the World is a production of the Yale Center for Faith and Culture at Yale Divinity School. This episode featured political scientist Andra Gillespie and theologian Ryan McAnally-Lins. I'm Evan Rosa, and I edited and produced the show. For more information, visit us online at faith.yale.edu. New episodes drop every Saturday, and you can subscribe through any podcast app. We hope you're enjoying the show, and we hope that you'd consider supporting us. Three ways that you can do that are as follows. You can share the show with a friend by text or email, and then I hope you talk about it. You could post it on your social feed, or you could open up Apple Podcasts right now, just after listening, to review and rate the show. Now we're asking you to share and support us because maintaining human connection is really important these days. We were not meant to live at distance from one another. So we hope this show is just a small, consistent way you can keep connecting, keep growing, keep seeking a life that is worthy of our shared humanity. We'll be back with more this coming week. Thanks, friends.